KALW.
We were appreciative to our fans, and we gave them that appreciation, and they gave it back.
Today, homegrown A's pitching ace Dave Stewart reflects on the team's last season in Oakland.
Playing in the backyard of the place that I grew up was a motivation for me.
It's the next episode from our series, Foul Ball. Then we hear stories of motherhood through adoption. We hear how it can begin.
You just stared right at me, and I think I fell in love with you the minute I saw you.
And where it can go.
I had just talked myself into the fact that family didn't matter. Then you showed up, and suddenly, family was all around me.
Moms Talk Mothering. I'm Hanat Baba, and this is Cross Currents. The Oakland A's are on a winning streak, but that's not bringing the fans back. Today, we start with the inside baseball from the next episode of our new series, Foul Ball. Here's host Sunny Khaled.
I'm Sunny Khaled, KALW's news editor, and welcome to Foul Ball, a season-long series looking at what is the A's final season in Oakland, which will also mark the end of Major League team sports in a city that boasted all four a half century ago. So sit back, relax, and listen to a dirge of what is and what once was. The Oakland A's hit the road 3 weeks ago for an East Coast swing, soon after owner John Fisher announced he was moving the team next season to Sacramento. The A's got swept in their three-game series against the Guardians in Cleveland. Then the team with the lowest payroll in the major leagues headed to the Big Apple to take on the league-leading Yankees, a team with one of the biggest payrolls. The scrappy A's split four games with the vaunted Yankees as Oakland closer Mason Miller continued to impress.
Juan Soto, swing and a miss, 102.
Juan Soto slams his bat to the ground because Mason Miller has owned him this week.
Volpe at first, Yankees trail by two, bottom of the ninth.
In the air, lifted, calling for it is Butler. He reaches in and the Oakland A's have split the series here in the Bronx.
There weren't many fans at the Coliseum to welcome the A's back home. As of Monday, the A's are averaging just 6,400 fans a game. By far the worst attendance in the big leagues. And that's too bad, because the battling A's reeled off six straight wins. On Saturday, the A's pounded Miami 20-4 as outfielder designator Brett Rooker, the squad's only All-Star last year, became the first A to homer twice in the same inning in 30 years.
3-2 to Rooker. Fly ball, deep to left field. Rooker provides the thunder after the rain. He said, I hit 440. Last night, how about 447 today?
Step on it.
The A's are just a game under 500 and have won 17 games. It took last year's squad until June to accomplish that feat. But despite the early season heroics, one still wonders how many fans will be in the Coliseum when the A's play their final game there on September 26th. In the last episode, I spoke with Andy Dolich, the co-author of Goodbye Oakland, about the A's last stand in the East Bay. Recently, I had a conversation with Dave Stewart. The East Oakland native was the intimidating ace of the A's starting rotation in the late 80s and early 90s. I spoke with Stu about the imminent departure of the team he grew up rooting for just a few blocks from where he grew up.
My cousin Kevin and Daryl, we used to ride our bicycles, which probably 3-4 blocks, to a Union 76 station that was on the corner of San Leandro and 66. And we'd chain our bikes up and walk down the railroad tracks, hop the fence, and we'd be in the Coliseum. I always tell people I had season tickets.
How was that?
Hopping the fence. can't get me now. Statute of limitations got to be over now, right? You know, unfortunately for me, my father passed away, so I wasn't going to very many Giants games later on. So when the A's came in 68, that was perfect timing for me to be able to get to games and, you know, just be around a sport that I was growing to love and grew to love through my father. Well, Reggie Jackson was my first encounter, and we had hopped the fence to get into a game, but we got there early enough for BP, and we were fielding fly balls that were hitting the seats. And Reggie turned his back on the infield, waiting for us to show our faces again, and shouted up at us, "Old man Finley's going to throw you out of here." And, you know, we told him old man Finley couldn't keep us from getting in, so he's certainly not going to throw us out. Rick Mundy ended up hitting a home run in that game. We circled around back to get an autograph from Rick on the ball that he hit. He wouldn't sign for us. So, you know, we were a little sad, but started walking back through the tunnel to head to our bicycles. And Reggie was the last person to come out. He remembered our exchange and, you know, called us smart asses is what he called us. But, you know, eventually asked us where we were going, where we lived, and if we needed a ride to our bicycles, which we did not accept because I told him my mother wouldn't let us take rides from strangers. And so we picked up our bikes. He slow drove behind us. And the next homestead, he drove down our street. We did the same thing we always did. But this time we went around back and waited for him by his car. That started the relationship. He started leaving us tickets and really became friendly with Reggie at that time and built a friendship with him until I started playing high school ball and eventually got drafted by the Dodgers.
Tell me a little bit about that relationship between Black Oakland and those original Oakland A's.
The original A's, on the pitching staff, you had Blue Moon Odom, you had Vida Blue, Catfish Hunter, Ken Holzman, Paul Lindblad, and Raleigh Fingers was on the back end. When the A's came and did a great deal for East Oakland, which is where I grew up, we started seeing development around the Coliseum and hotels. The Eastmont Mall went up about the same time that the A's came, which at that time became the biggest shopping center in the Bay Area. We've now had Taco Bell's and McDonald's and Church's Chicken, which that Church's Chicken is still there on the corner of 73rd and Bancroft. It just became a great area. The area was flourishing. It was in a turbulent time because the Black Panthers were having their differences with Oakland police. The Symbian A's Liberation Army was part of that period of time. And in Berkeley, there were always demonstrations. And so we were in a turbulent time, but having the A's in town gave us some type of relief from that. And having the relationships with the players that me and my cousins had gave us an idea that we could actually become major league athletes and major league players. And so it was Oakland. And anything that was Oakland, there became a sense of pride for it. And there was great support for it from our community, especially.
You signed with the Dodgers, went through their organization, made a stop in Texas. What was it like for you to come back and play at the Coliseum, a few blocks from where you grew up? What was it like to come back as a member of the opposition?
It was actually crazy. And, you know, those were not very good times for me, especially the way I was being used by the teams that I played for. Coming into Oakland, and I didn't have any idea that I didn't perform well in my hometown. Obviously, a lot of it has to do with the fact that you're playing at home, trying to show off and perform well, the pressure of leaving tickets and, you know, accommodating family versus concentrating on playing baseball. So I didn't perform very well here, and I didn't perform very well in San Francisco either.
You were in the big leagues for 8 years before the opportunity presented itself to come home. What was it like for you to come home and live and pitch at home?
Now I'm in uniform with the A's, and so they pitched me very little. And so I was talking to Johnny B. Baker, Dusty. I'd been there a couple of months and still wasn't getting any opportunities to pitch. And I told Dusty, I said, "Bake, I've gone full circle now. I'm back at home, and I'm not getting an opportunity to play. I think I'm going to just call it." And Bake made a statement that stuck with me. He said, "Stu," he says, "you never know what's going to happen. I'm telling you, never give that uniform back. Make them take it off your back. Don't ever give the uniform back." And I ended up staying. Within 3 weeks, Jackie Moore and Wes Stock were fired. Tony La Russa and Dave Duncan came. And that was the change for me. After they came, I started getting opportunities. I was Tony's first starter as the manager. And he fit me in the rotation. And I never left the rotation until I became a free agent to go to Toronto.
In 88, you won 20 games, and you were in three straight World Series for the Athletics, matching the success of the teams that you had grown up rooting for. What was that like?
After being given the opportunity to be in the rotation on a regular basis and, you know, have the opportunity to learn and really figure out and define who I was as a pitcher and having the opportunity for the growth, it was a moment that I had actually been waiting for. And it was funny how things came together, the maturity and the growth with what I always believed to be the person and the pitcher that I was. Having the opportunity to pitch at home, and I think being around my family, my mother in particularly, was a motivation for me. Playing in the backyard of the place that I grew up was a motivation for me. Having the opportunity to be involved with the boys' club and the girls' club, that a place that I had grown up in as a youth, and being able to give back to them, I was motivated by that. And so, needless to say, having the opportunity to play at home, play in front of my family and friends, to be able to give back to some of the community organizations that had helped me in my growth, it was a dream come true.
And the A's were drawing back then. You drew almost 3 million fans.
We were a very, very good team. We competed every year. We contended every year. We went back-to-back-to-back years to the World Series. The only thing unfortunate about that is we only won one with a team that was good enough to win three. The Bay Area supported what we brought to the table. I mean, we had different ways to win baseball games. We could pitch. We could run. We could defend. If we had to win a one game, 1-0, we win 1-0. If we had to outslug you, we outslug you. But more importantly, we played with pride for the city, and we recognized the city. I mean, in everything that we did, we were appreciative to our fans, and we gave them that appreciation, and they gave it back.
1992, you left. Free agency. You didn't want to leave Oakland, did you?
I didn't. I envisioned myself finishing my career from 1986 until whenever I decided to retire, which was 1995. I saw myself being a part of that team and continuing to be a part of the community.
What is it like for you to see the A's in the shape they're in now on the field? And also, what is it like for you to contemplate that this is going to be the last season that that team is going to play at the Coliseum and that they're going to go to Sacramento to a minor league stadium for a few years and then on to Las Vegas?
As an Oakland native, a person who knows the background and history of this organization since they came here in 1968, I remember Charlie Oldmule prancing around the field, and I remember the umpires reaching right behind him for the rabbit that came up behind home plate to get baseballs. Now, I remember when Vida Blue threw his first pitch. I remember that what set the A's apart from every other team in baseball and made them unique were the white shoes. You know, when you remember 72, 73, and 74, and the great players that had come through this organization, Catfish and Reggie and Raleigh and Ricky Henderson, Joe Rudy, I mean, the names go on and on about the pride tradition of the A's organization. It's painful. The city of Oakland is, they're going to feel it. The city will feel the impact and the loss of the Oakland A's organization. But strictly from a standpoint of a fan and a kid that grew up watching this team, it's really, really painful.
That was former star pitcher Dave Stewart. He was a member of the A's last World Series championship team in 1989 when they swept the San Francisco Giants. You can find all the episodes from Foul Ball at klw.org/foulball. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. Maya Angelou once said, "Love recognizes no barriers. It jumps hurdles, leaps fences, penetrates walls to arrive at its destination full of hope. There are few things that embody her idea as much as a mother's love. So, in honor of Mother's Day this Sunday, we're bringing you personal stories about motherhood and adoption. First, we meet Lori Bruckner. Before she adopted her daughter, Kate, she knew her only as a blown-up photocopied photograph. On the photograph was a Chinese name, Yu Mingren. Anxiously, Lori traveled all the way to Jiangsu in China to adopt her. Soon, Mingren became Kate. 15 years later, Kate sat down with her mom in the San Francisco StoryCorps booth to ask her what it was like when she saw Kate for the first time.
The first time I saw you was on a tiny little picture from an adoption agency. It was about like 2 inches wide by an inch tall. I remember my friend Kenny, he scanned the photo and he sent it all over the United States to different people, like to your grandparents and to Aunt Sarah and Uncle Paul and Terry and Greg and everybody who could possibly I'd want to show that picture I sent it to. And I remember the next time I saw you was in China. This nanny brought you through the door and you were bundled up. You had all these clothes on. Your face was really red and it looked kind of flushed. And at the time, I didn't realize how scared you probably were. I just was feeling pretty selfish about how happy I was. I remember, you know, I was told I shouldn't be looking you in the eye when I first met you. And because they said that, the adoption agency said that maybe that some adopted babies weren't used to having eye contact, but obviously you were because you just stared right at me. And I think I fell in love with you, although I didn't know what to do with you yet because I didn't know what to do as a mom. But I saw you and I just fell in love with you the minute I saw you. I sort of thought about your birth mother, but she didn't seem real to me till I was holding you in my arms and I realized that I was so happy, but it was kind of sad too because she would not hold you in her arms. And I felt also sad for you that you wouldn't feel her hold you in her arms. So that was super happy, but at the same time, pretty sad. And another more less esoteric thing is that Kate actually sounds like me on the phone. When people call us, they always go, "Hello, Lori," and you'll go, "No, it's Kate." Which is really kind of funny because we're not biologically related, but we sound alike, don't we?
People say.
All the time. I think we do.
Lori Bruckner spoke to her daughter Kate at the San Francisco StoryCorps booth in 2014. Next, an adopted daughter discovers twice the love. Lamar Van Dyke, Paula Lewis, and Tracy Lewis have a special bond. Lamar gave birth to Tracy when she was 18 years old. Unprepared to have a baby, she gave Tracy up for adoption. And the person who adopted her is Paula Lewis. Now, grown daughter Tracy sat down with her biological mom, Lamar, and her adopted mom, Paula, in the StoryCorps booth at the San Francisco Public Library to talk about their family.
I'm Lamar Van Dyke, and I'm here with my daughter, Tracy Lewis, and her fabulous adopted mom, Paula.
My name is Paula Marie Lewis. I'm with my daughter, Tracy Lewis, and her bio mother, Lamar Van Dyke.
I'm Tracy Lewis, and I'm the biological daughter of Lamar and the adopted daughter of Paula.
Over the years of my life, how did you cope with
Did you think about, well, she's 10 now, I hope she's happy, is she safe, does she have a good life? Did those thoughts, what were your hopes and fears for me?
Oh yeah, when I was still living in San Francisco, whenever I would see anybody walking down the street with a little black girl that was about the age of you, I'd think, wonder if that's her.
Mm-hmm.
Wonder if that's her.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you turned 18, I registered my name with an adoption finding agency because I thought, well, you know, I don't really feel like I have the right to go looking for you, but if you're looking for me, I'd like to make myself available for that.
Mm-hmm. How did you feel when, out of the clear blue, I contacted you 21 years ago?
Oh, I had a heart attack. I always knew that we would find each other. And I always thought I'd be completely reasonable and sensible about it. That I'd say, oh, how nice to meet you. Here, let me put you on the back of my motorcycle and we'll go to the ocean and I'll answer all your questions and we'll live happily ever after. Mm-hmm. That's what I thought.
Mm-hmm.
But when you found me, the top of my head blew off and I started pacing up and down the hallway of my house, holding on to my head, thinking, oh my God, it's my daughter.
One of the things, Lamar, that I really love about you is you never tried to take over anything. Because, you know, there was that fear, like I said, when she was younger, I thought, my God, if her mother comes along and tries to take her from me, even though legally it couldn't have happened, I had this concern. But you always sort of stayed on your side of the fence. You didn't come into her life to be her mother.
Yeah.
You didn't come in her life to take over or to redo any of the teachings or any of the upbringing from her. And I've always told everybody, I think that's so admirable.
You were the mother. In my mind, you were the mother. You had done the mother work, and you were the mother, and I had the utmost respect for that. And I was just so happy to be included in your family.
And you are a family. But I think that for me, that helped me so much.
Before I met you, the two of you, I had sort of talked myself into the idea that family didn't matter. Because my family had been harsh with me and I had left them and gone off to live my queer life. And I had just talked myself into the fact that family didn't matter. Then you showed up and suddenly family was all around me and in me. And I was elevated to a different level.
Mm-hmm.
I was connected to something that I had not been connected to.
I think myself that you actually showed up at the perfect time, wouldn't you say, Mom?
Oh,
she got
yes.
to skip all the turmoil.
I wish you had come during the teenage years, however. Maybe that's...
I probably wouldn't have been too good with that.
So you waited, and then, you know, the grandkids, and you showed up right at the perfect time.
Yeah, it's been great.
Yeah.
It's been great.
Mm-hmm. I'm just divinely blessed, grateful to have you both.
That was Lamar Van Dyke, Paula Lewis, and Tracy Lewis. They recorded that segment for StoryCorps in 2018. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Bhabha. There are many songs that come to mind when we think about moms. I love the song I'll Always Love My Mama by The Intruders. For producer Juan Moreno-Haynes of Uncuffed, one of his is Dear Mama by Tupac Shakur.
Uncuffed.
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 My mixtape.
My mixtape.
My mixtape.
My mixtape.
Really not a hip-hop fan, but I remember when he started becoming popular, it was the lyrics. It was his storytelling through song that really attracted me.
When I was young, me and my mama had beef, 17 years old, kicked out on the streets. Though back at the time, I never thought I'd see a face. Ain't a woman alive that could take my mama's place.
Listening to Tupac kind of made a lot of things relevant. You know, he spoke to a lot of issues that I was going through. It's not so much as the specific lyrics to that song, but it's how Tupac sings it with such passion when he's saying, "Dear Mama," he'll go through these scenarios, realizing how strong his mother was in his life and how he kind of didn't really acknowledge that during the times when he was struggling. And I was actually playing this song when I got arrested. So I really wish that I would have, at least like first time when I went to prison, when my mom was going through a lot of anxiety, that I really wish I was honest with her, but I wasn't. You know, I was still too self-centered. There's no way I can pay you back, but the plan is to show you that I understand. You all appreciate it. Dear Mama, please, no one above you. You all appreciate it. And then she wasn't there for me the second time, so I was kind of like left out there. My daddy, because the coward wasn't there. He passed away, and I didn't cry, because my anger wouldn't let me feel for a stranger. They say I'm wrong.
That was Juan Moreno-Haynes talking about Dear Mama by Tupac Shakur. You can find more Uncuffed mixtapes at KALW.org/uncuffed. I moved out, started really hanging. I needed money of my own, so I started slanging. I ain't guilty, because even though I sell rocks, it feels good putting money in your mailbox. Today's Cross Currents team includes Steffi Puerto, Cheryl Kaskowitz, James Rollins, Ganadijo Johnson, Victor Tenz, Shirin Hadil, Merz Ortega-Welch, Angela Johnston, Lisa Morehouse, and Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet, as interpreted by Daoud Anthony. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba. And Mama made miracles every Thanksgiving, but now the road got rough, you're alone.